Hello and welcome to Kenny's G League, the only podcast all about your Rip City remix. Today's episode is a very special one. We have a chat with Alex Sarama, who is the director of player development and assistant coach for the Rip City Remix. He has some really exciting ideas about what coaching means, how to implement ideas in basketball for all ages of players. It's a really interesting conversation. I'm excited to dive into that one. But first, we're going to talk about the end of the Remix's season and wrap up the last quarter of the season here. So let's do a little bit of review. In case you missed it, the Remix just barely missed out on the playoffs in their inaugural season. I have to give them some serious kudos for that. Making the playoffs, or just barely missing the playoffs, is an accomplishment in season one of a team's history. So kudos there. In this regular season, the Remix ended 18 wins, 16 losses for a winning percentage of 0.529. And just to show how deep the Western Conference is, the Remix, the South Bay Lakers, and the Texas Legends all ended the regular season going 18 wins and 16 losses. And the teams above them were not very far ahead. The Mexico City Capitanes had 19 wins. The Austin Spurs in seventh place had 20 wins. And the Rio Grande Valley Vipers had 20 wins, as well as the Salt Lake City Stars and the Santa Cruz Warriors. All 20 wins, so just two wins ahead of the Remix. And of course, the Remix's final two games were versus the Santa Cruz Warriors. So it's not difficult to imagine a world where those two flip-flop in the standings. So kudos to the Remix for a really well done first season. Let's take a look at some other stats from players on the team and see how they stacked up this season. Antoine Davis, the shooting guard for the Remix, led the entire league in three-pointers made with 117 on the season. He was also the first to 100, which they were quick to note. Other players making some stat leaders categories: George Condit the fourth. He was third place in field goal percentage at 65.4%. And Ashton Higgins had 9.7 assists per game. That's tied with the first place winner, Elfrid Payton, also 9.7 assists. Other players that spent some time with the Remix in season leaders categories are Jamari Bouye, who ended the season with the Austin Spurs. He had 2.1 steals per game. That's good for fourth in the league. And old friend Greg Brown III was second in the league in blocks per game at 2.6. So lots of players with some connections here, leading the league in various categories. Other players that I think were big for the Remix this year were Tajay Moore. I think he had a very important season for the Remix, and he had some really exciting highlights, some dunks that just blew the roof off. That was really exciting. Additionally, some players that I enjoyed watching develop this year were Ibu Baji. I'm very excited about what he could become in the NBA with the Blazers. And I liked seeing Kevin Knox back with the team back in Portland after he kind of got traded around in the NBA a bit. He ended up back on the Remix, and it was great to see him. You can really see that he's got those NBA skills. He just kind of needs, in my opinion, a spot to land. Alex Reiss, I want to shout Alex Reiss out too. A stretch four that I think has so much potential, especially with his three-point shot really coming around. Really exciting player as well. Another highlight of this last quarter of the season for me was just recently Hand Fruit Night. I have to give a big shout out to our friend Seth, aka Sheriff of Portland, who was a big part in setting up this event. We had about 50 or 60 people show out to the second to last game, and we had matching shirts that were provided by Basket Ghoul. It was an excellent time, very exciting. Really great event. I was glad we were able to do that before the season was out. So without further ado, let's get into our conversation with Alex Sarama. Today, we're joined by Alex Sarama. He is the Director of Player Development and Assistant Coach for the Remix, as well as the founder of Transforming Basketball and the author of Transforming Basketball, Changing How We Think About Basketball Performance, which comes out April 9th. Alex, thank you very much for joining the podcast. How are you doing this morning?
Eric, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm doing great. I mean, obviously, we would have loved to have made playoffs, but I'm really positive about the season, and I can't speak highly enough of the experience I had, both from the perspective of the environment the Blazers organization created for us, and then the coaching staff. And I think that starts with Jim Moran. I think the culture we had, I think it's, I don't think it gets better in the G League. And it made it really a pleasure to turn up to work every day, despite the Pacific rain that I was getting used to for the first time. It was just going into the office, you know, made everything better with the environment we had there. So, you know, thank you as well for your support. I think made a big difference in our inaugural season.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear that it was such a positive experience. I'm sure anything in their first season, you know, has ups and downs. So I'm glad that everything overall was really positive. So I have a few things that I'd like to talk about today, both including the Remix season and what that was like, as well as kind of talking about your approach to coaching and what coaching means to you and all the different places that coaching has taken you. From what I understand, you've coached all over the world, really. I see you're traveling all over the world and coaching at many different skill levels. So I guess I'd like to start there, and maybe we'll start with, how did you get your introduction into coaching?
Great question. So I'm from England originally, as the listeners I'm sure can tell with the accent. So basketball it's growing now, but when I was growing up, it wasn't a big sport by any means. And that really just emboldened me, I think, to be even more passionate about the game. So I was playing growing up. I was an average player, probably like a Division III equivalent. And I realized from a very early age that the way to stay involved in basketball would be through coaching. And so I actually started when I was 16, Eric.
Wow.
And that was one of the perks of being in the UK, because basketball was so underdeveloped. I was able to coach in my school. So I took all younger kids, and that just gave me the experience and the reps from an early age, figuring stuff out, learning how to run practices, etc. And I started my own club. And that went on to become really big. We produced like 10 players for England, like junior. And that was when I was between 16 and 21 years old. So I was going to university. I went to Nottingham in the middle of England, read modern history. And then I was coming back every weekend to run the club. I had a coaching staff of like 8 coaches who I was managing as like a teenager almost. So it was a great experience.
That's amazing.
And that set the foundation for me working for the NBA league office, Europe, Middle East and Africa. Obviously did a lot in the States, and everything kind of just soared from that moment on, really.
That's really interesting. Yeah. That's interesting that basketball is not as big of a sport over there. You know, I mean, obviously soccer and many other things, but that's fascinating. I remember, I think the only person is Joel Freeland,
That's exactly it.
So, and I only know him because he was a Blazers legend.
So he had a good career in the NBA, but we've got Luol Deng.
Of course.
The pool, but really not much else. So John Amiche was the first real Brit, but really I'd say it would be John, Joel, and Luol, and that's really it.
Yeah. That's cool. That's really neat that you were able to kind of find that niche early on and ride that. And so as you got coaching from a pretty young age, it sounds like you've developed a fairly unique approach to coaching. And as I've kind of been diving into some of your work, you talk about some things like constraint-led approaches and ecological dynamics. And it sounds like a lot of this, if I'm understanding it correctly, is kind of coming from a starting point of working with how the body moves in general, which to me, I'm no coach or anything. I played basketball as a child, you know, even reading about that now was so interesting because just starting from a place of movement was something that I don't think anyone, when I went to basketball camp as a kid or, you know, basketball practice, whatever, was ever talked about at all. It was, here are some one-handed shooting drills. Here are, we're going to, you know, run you up and down the court and whatnot. So I thought that was really interesting. So I guess I'd like to start with, before we dive into those topics a little more independently, what do you start with for your coaching philosophy in general?
Absolutely, Eric. Great question. So really what I'm trying to pioneer within the basketball space, and I'd even say the wider sports world, because I've been doing a lot of other sports over the last 2 years, but obviously basketball is my thing, is trying to highlight the importance of having a theory that is informed by science and research, which shapes how we coach. And I think often this is the elephant in the room, because we've had over 50, 60, 70, 80 years in both basketball and other sports, a lot of myths have developed and a lot of drills and approaches, which actually are kind of the total opposite to what the science informs us.
Yeah.
And as such, what we see, Eric, is a lot of these things kind of become enculturated in basketball. So, you know, you could go to a lot of different practices at different levels, from NBA to grassroots, and you would see the exact same ideas, drills on display. But what the research shows us is that how the human body moves is actually very different, and the way we need to coach needs to align with what we know about that. Otherwise, we might actually be hindering development or even maybe making the players worse. So I'm really trying to bring awareness to this movement. And good thing too, Eric, is, I mean, it's, I didn't do the research. There are a lot of very smart professors and researchers all over the world who did this work in motor. It's called motor learning in North America, skill acquisition in the rest of the world.
Interesting.
And that's the field. And they've done all the hard work for us. And really, I realized when I started coaching that no one was doing this in basketball. So I've really just tried to pioneer it through transforming basketball and, you know, give this movement some light. And I think I really believe it's the future of our sport. And I'm very excited to see where it could go. And that's every level, whether it's beginners or the NBA.
Yeah, man, that is really fascinating. You know, just as I've been listening to some of your stuff, it kind of made me appreciate in a way that I had never before that coaching, as silly as it sounds to come to this realization now, is you know, a form of education. And honestly, it's kind of crazy to me that I hadn't really put it in that context before. You know, again, when I was a kid going to basketball camp, the coaches were the people that just told you, you know, where to go or whatever, but they weren't educating so much, you know. And like, it's been kind of fun to dive into your stuff, because like, on a couple days a week, I have worked as a music educator for several years.
Fantastic.
And it's been kind of interesting already, even just recently, to start to think about, okay, in what ways that I'm, you know, maybe teaching a elementary age kid to use their hands, you know, to play guitar or to play ukulele or whatever they're playing at a young age, in what ways should I probably rethink how I'm, you know, teaching that, to go from like, do this, this, and this, versus, I don't know, how you might think of it, in more of a exploratory way or something like that.
Exactly. So, Eric, you know, this is a fascinating topic, because I can tell you now, I might diverge, but my biggest hobby outside of basketball is I play jazz saxophone.
Oh, no way. That's awesome.
And when I was figuring this out early on, so it was really about 5-6 years ago where I really came across the research and started trying to incorporate it. And I was drawing a lot of parallels to how I'd learned to play music, because we have this idea of the scales, you know, you've got to learn these scales first before you can play songs. And it's kind of the exact same thing as fundamentals. And mm-hmm. it's quite funny. You'll see actually in my book, all the chapters, I started with quotes from jazz musicians, which are relevant for what was in that chapter, because I think there are so many similarities in the field. And
yeah,
I've actually done a lot of work over the last 3 years. I've had multiple conversations with musicians. There's actually a whole, the University of Sydney, they have a whole field in their jazz center dedicated to ecological dynamics. I've done calls with law enforcement trainers, horse riders, and it's so interesting because these ideas, they apply to everything in life, like you said.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. I mean, I feel like the parallels are right there, you know. And I think one of your videos that I was watching, something you said made me think about how when I was a music student in like high school and stuff, I would be learning a scale or whatever. Yeah. And at the time I had a teacher and he would essentially just say, okay, now improvise, you know. And for whatever reason, and I see this in a lot of my students now, you know, the response is freeze, right? Which is totally understandable, to be honest, you know, because it's not built up, I guess, at least in my mind, from a starting place of, okay, how, or not even how, it's not built from a starting place of exploration and inquisitiveness, if that makes sense. Starting from a place of, I have something that's within a rigid framework, and now suddenly, okay, now do something interesting in this rigid framework, which is in anything really challenging to do. So I guess that'll bring me with that in mind. You've got these kind of specific ideas like constraint-led approach. So is that an okay place to start, kind of
that's
diving into what that means?
And I think this is a really good link, because what you just said in basketball, the equivalent would be, you know, let's put players in a drill where there's no opponent, where they know what's going to happen before the repetition starts. It's predetermined.
Okay, yeah.
And then let's hope that they can be successful in the game. That's exactly how I do. And this is kind of what I'm, the kind of the whole essence for the listeners here, without having to go really deep into the science. It's how can we create environments which are more representative of what they will encounter in the real thing? And ultimately, what we know is basketball, it's such a dynamic sport. It's so unpredictable. Anything can happen. And it's based on interactions between the defense and teammates. So for me, I view it as counterproductive when, you know, it would then go to practice and we would spend, you know, coaches would spend considerable amounts of time where it's all predetermined and the players know the answer before the drill starts. Really, when what we look at with the constraints that approach is, it's informed by, you mentioned it earlier on, ecological dynamics. And that is, if you Google that, you'll see a lot come up, but it's a framework that we can use to make sense of movement in human beings. So it's just how we move humans. So what we hear of a lot in sports is terms like muscle memory, and you might have heard, and it actually doesn't exist. That and we have this misnomer in, and you know, it's every, I've spoken to coaches in NFL, like Major League Hockey, Major League Baseball. It's all the same as the NBA. And we have this idea that the brain is kind of like a super computing machine, which store these techniques and patterns and bring it out in the game. But what we know of ecological dynamics is that the brain doesn't work like that.
Interesting.
We're basically perceiving things in our environment and acting. And this is the interesting, as we're acting, we're perceiving new information. So let's say I was to just leave my house here and start walking towards the Blazers practice gym. I would be seeing things in my environment. And as I'm walking, as I'm trying to cross the road, I'm seeing new information, and that shapes future movement action. So essentially what that means in practical terms in basketball and anything in any other sport is the ability to be a skilled player is based on your ability to have these functional perception action couplings. So what that means is it's not about having a technique or a movement, because a lot of the time the way a technique is taught, you can't even apply that in the game, because the environment and the defense shapes what you can do and what you can't do. So it's really a simple way of looking at it is trying to have a decision in, you know, as much as what we're doing as possible. And the idea is that we can use these constraints to create these very specific environments. So it's, if I kind of set up just a random game, like let's say a one-on-one, some good stuff might happen, but it's probably not going to be that effective from a learning perspective because it's not constrained. So anything can happen and the players aren't going to pick up new information that maybe they're not picking up. They might be able to resort to some similar tendencies that they already do. So the idea is we kind of use constraints to destabilize certain movements and getting them picking up new information. So the easiest example might be, okay, we're going to play a one-on-one, but against the coach maybe, but we're going to have you always drive from a new location because how you move coming from the corner is going to be very different coming from the top compared to maybe coming from the high post of a low post. And as well as that, we're going to give you a 3-second shot clock. So the movement is faster, more decisive, as we'd see in the game. And we're also going to constrain where you can score from. So I call it a gold medal shot, which is a shot inside the smile. And a silver medal is a 3-pointer. So I like having these metaphors and analogies to help with the learning process. Yeah. So suddenly, Eric, with some tiny changes from our base 1-on-1, we've now got a really useful activity. And the fun part is we can individualize this activity based on the player's needs. And I call it a rate limiter. There's a whole section in my book. So, you know, imagine that different player, every player is different. So I don't believe in copy paste methodologies where they're all treated the same. And maybe they're all doing the exact same drill because what one player needs is going to be completely different for what another player needs and their rate of development. So what we could do is individualize these constraints. So for one player, maybe we say, okay, we're going to have an extra defender. So it's actually going to be a 1-against-2. Because we've really got to improve your ability to handle against pressure and in tight spaces. Whereas for this other player, we need to improve your weak hand. So we're going to say you can only finish with your weak hand at the rim. Or another player, maybe there's a good opportunity for them to look for more finishes off 2 feet because they're coming in and they're getting bumped when there's a defender on their hip. So we might over-constrain it in a short dose because we don't say, you know, finish off 2 feet every time like we see in college. Sure. Be conducive, but maybe just for a few minutes of a practice, we do that and we see what happens. So this is kind of the intellectual part of it, which really excites me because you can create such a cutting edge learning environment with this approach.
Yeah. Right?
So different to the dominant approach, I call it, which is, you know, one size fits all drills, kind of no opponent, just repetition. Mm-hmm. Instead, with this approach, what we're trying to get is repetition without repetition. And that's
I love that. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what has that looked like in your experience so far using these ideas with maybe, say, a younger age versus a player that's maybe had a high school or college experience? Yeah. You know, is it what do those two groups look like when Absolutely, you put these things into practice?
So for me, it's a great question because when I started with this, my biggest concern was, but how can we do this with young kids where they've got, when they've never played basketball, how can we go in and create environments and go live without having to do drills and fundamentals? And it took me years to figure it out. And for me, the key answer lies in simplifying the activity and reducing the challenge point. So there's this concept in motor learning called optimal challenge point. And the researchers behind it were Guadagnoli and Lee, and it came out in 1979, so years old. And really what they said, Eric, was that in any activity, the challenge has to be just right to have an optimal value for learning. So if it's too difficult, probably not much use. But if it's too easy, which is the biggest problem what we see right now, grassroots, there's no value. So goes to show, you know, we could theoretically say that we're 50 years behind in some regard, you know, when the research has been there for so long. But anyway, it's with beginners and younger players, it's the key is to simplify it with constraints. So what I might say is, okay, the defense, you're going to play defense with no hands, but you're trying to make the miss with how you position your body. And when they shoot it, you're trying to get the rebound to stop the possession. If the offensive player gets the rebound, they can keep scoring. So that would be a very creative way. Maybe it's one hand. Maybe we limit the steps they can take. So I say, okay, it's a live one-on-one, but you only have three steps. Sometimes I get them holding a bib or a basketball and they play defense on the ball. So it's basically about being really creative. And I think the key thing for younger kids, which is the biggest problem in the States, is that you guys don't often have these lower baskets and the smaller basketball.
Oh, interesting.
So this is really funny because, you know, in the NBA, everyone's been talking about European basketball and why there's so many European players in the NBA. And I can tell, I've been fortunate enough, Eric, to have traveled to over 40 countries now and most of Europe. And I've seen basically basketball at every level in Europe. And it's, the coaching is still very much based on the dominant approach. It's, I'm actually doing some work now with a few federations like Sweden, Germany, where we're going all in CLA, and they're doing this with coaches across the whole country. But still, 98% of European basketball is fundamentals. But the reason the players are better is because from a young age, they have the reason they're more skilled is because they have 8-foot rims and size 5 basketballs. So sure enough, the basketball movements that emerge are more useful and they can actually do more skillful things.
Right. Because,
and there's a lot of research on this in motor learning. It's called equipment scaling.
Okay.
So basically you put that in, you will see in any sport, in tennis, it's like smaller rackets, smaller court, lower net. The results are overwhelming. Yet somehow, for some reason, in the States, this hasn't caught on. And I think the big reason why is often that, you know, the decision makers at like the federation-wide level, as opposed to getting in experts in skill acquisition, it's more focusing on like just coaches who have like retired and a narrow field of experience. And you need both. You need, yes, you need experience in the field, but that's got to be supplemented by research. So, and I know that's a very diluted answer, but
I love that.
I really believe it's AAU and equipment scaling, because in New York, we don't have the AAU. It's just club basketball. Really? Game means something. It's one game a week. So you have more quality practice, kids become more skillful. And I think if it's funny, I always say like, if the US figured it out, like the rest of FIBA competition would never stand a chance.
That's so interesting. And I mean, even from my perspective way over here, that does feel very American to just be like, here's the adult basketball, go figure it out.
No, I've actually, again, this is like the research side of me. So I actually investigated why I think that is. And we have another thing called something called forms of life, which are, it's a form of constraint, because with constraint, we've got three types of constraint. We've got task. So those are the ones, like the examples I gave you, like what we actually do with the activity, right? The rules of the games. We've got individual. So what I do a lot is I change the matchups and the defenders. So instead of playing against or with the same person, always mix it up. Why? Well, playing against much bigger versus shorter, slower versus faster defender will lead to new skills emerging. And the last type of constraint is environmental. And this is what I've just described. It's called Carl Newell's constraints model. He was a pioneering researcher who devised this. And environment constraints are, yes, they could be like physical things. So for instance, the weather, the surface, the lighting, but it's also the societal constraints, these forms of life. So for instance, American history, right? I studied obviously history at university. You've got a distinct policy of isolationism.
Right.
You know, that's the policy of a country to be, you know, away from what was going on. It was like 100 years you guys didn't get involved in like European wars or conflicts. And then that's led to a very distinct idea of like laissez-faire. And what that's led to is, I think the US is the only country in the world really where there's no shot clock, or it changes in every state. And it's not passed down from a federation who says you must do it. In every other country, it's governed by a federation. So
really,
it's fascinating, Eric, because this stuff goes so deep. And I know I'm nerding out on some of this stuff.
I love it. Really interesting.
It's really fascinating. And it shows, Eric, how development is so much more than what you do on the court in a session. Like, for instance, even here with the remix, I was trying to be very intentional about actually knowing all my players and their forms of life, because when you know that, it really might impact your approach and what you do with them.
Yeah. Taking it as a the person as a whole.
For sure.
Really. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Oh man, let's see here. You know, it is already making me think, as silly as it might sound. I have a nephew who's 5, and like this year he really got into basketball. You know, he's got like the adjustable hoop in his driveway,
great.
You know.
Yep.
And it's been really neat seeing him. At some point he got a smaller ball, you know.
Yep.
And I think the hoop is set at, I don't know how high it's set at, 7 feet or something like that. And since he got the adjustable hoop with the ball that he can actually handle and dribble a little bit, he's out there like swishing three pointers in his driveway, you know. And he's actually getting legitimately good as a 5-year old, you know. It's really cool to see.
Keep going. And think the scary thing is all the kids who give up or don't play basketball because they don't get that experience. And a lot of it's not just making them more skilled players, but actually as kids, why do you do sport? It's fun. It's engaging. Let's keep doing that. And if they can't have success, no wonder they drop out and they stop playing sport.
Right. And I have to, you know, imagine similar to when I might have like a guitar student, you know, something that I continually try to learn how to do better is kind of say to them and I guess to myself as well, okay, the goal for me oftentimes is not to make sure you have every single skill as a guitar player or become even the best guitar player, although sometimes that might be their goal and that's great. But especially since I'm working often with elementary age kids, high school usually being the oldest, you know, I'm trying to always get better at sort of doing how do we just make this a positive experience that like maybe you don't play music at all in the future, but it is a positive experience for you, and maybe it leads you to, I don't know, woodworking or something else that you can kind of take the skill of learning and apply it in some different form, you know what I mean?
Totally, Eric.
Like, and I'm sure you see that in basketball.
Oh, all the time. It's like I kind of say to people that people, like, let's take the Remix players now.
Yeah.
I kind of have the mantra of every interaction, every day, I want to make practice the best part of that day and the whole interaction they have with me. So even if it's a pre-practice segment where I have 12 minutes, let's really bring something different to the table where it's not a drill that they've done their whole career in the G League or college.
Yeah.
Let's do something different every single time. So they're stimulated to be there. Then I make the interaction with them purposeful and all of that. And it's the reason why is because they're, you know, in 10 years when players are retired or whatever, they're not going to remember the results.
Yeah.
Like very rarely. They're going to remember how you made them feel. And that is what is the most important thing. Like, and of course, yeah, the thing is, it's not a case of one over the other. We can still win at the highest level in the NBA while having a transformative culture where people, players, staff, coaches love being in the building every day.
Yeah.
And I think that's something I've really been very intentional about because it's all linked to motor learning research. There's a lot of research on, it's called transformational leadership. And a researcher called Jean Cotte who's done a lot of this. And it's just common sense. You know, I think if you have people who are empowered, who feel better, they're going to perform better at the end of the day.
Yeah. That is really fantastic. I am. What was the author there?
Sure. It was Jean. He's French. French Canadian. So J-E-A-N.
Gotcha.
And then his surname is Cotte, C-O-T-E.
Okay. I'm going to just type that in so I can save that for later.
No, absolutely. And there's another researcher, Amanda Vizek, who looked at fun in professional sport in the Olympics. And she found out that even Olympians need fun to perform better and be more driven. And it's so funny because it's so counterproductive to what we see, unfortunately, in a lot of basketball settings. Mm-hmm. And again, like what I said at the start of the podcast, it's just one of the many reasons I loved working for Jim. The culture he created was incredible. And it's, you know, it aligns with all of this research.
That's really neat. Yeah, I've heard nothing but really positive things from the people I've talked to about Jim. Sounds great.
Definitely.
Some really interesting stuff, man. I am so curious to look at some of these people a little bit more later on.
Another guy, Eric, sorry, I don't want to
Oh, no, go for it.
Another a really interesting person will be Nikolai Bernstein.
Okay.
And his research is over 100 years old, Eric. So it's crazy. And he's the guy who's influenced a lot of half the field of ecological dynamics.
Okay.
Because he was working in the Soviet Union, right?
Hmm.
And obviously then it was communism. They had that policy of collectivism where it was trying to be as efficient as possible with the yield.
Mm-hmm.
So Soviet authorities commissioned a case study for him where he had to research the blacksmiths. And they basically said to him, we need our blacksmiths to be more efficient. Let's look at, you know, how we can do that. And they mm-hmm. had the hypothesis that the best blacksmiths they had were the most efficient in terms of what they were producing, because they had the exact same technique every time they hit the iron with their chisel,
uh-huh.
right? Same repeatable technique.
Yeah.
Think back to basketball, right? It's that mm-hmm. same mentality. Let's try and get mm-hmm. players repeating the same technique. So what he found was profound for motor learning as a field, because it was actually the expert blacksmiths who had the most variability compared to the beginners.
Wow.
And the reason why is because even in a very, very closed environment, like hammering a nail, you've still got constraints,
mm-hmm.
fatigue, you know, all these things. It means that you can't use the exact same movement solution every time.
Right.
You know, basketball, more than 100 years later, in most practices at all levels, it's the opposite to that. It's trying to get players moving the exact same way.
Yeah.
And it is physically impossible to move the same way in a game. You just, no two movements is the same. So
okay, yeah.
The whole thing is, if we know that's the case, why are we still practicing like this?
Yeah. So cool. I mean, I think about players that, like, I've seen come through the Blazers, you know,
sure.
And you kind of get this sense with some players, and maybe I'm way off, that, you know, I can think of players, you know, catching the ball, and you can kind of see the wheels turning in their mind. I've practiced something like this before. I have a list of A, B, and C that I can do. I am hoping to choose the right one, you know, and you can see the wheels turning versus other players that almost seem to be playing the game outside of the game, you know, obviously yeah. like Jokic or someone like that. It's like
yeah.
he's seeing a whole new sport, you know.
Exactly. That is that's such a good practical example. And that's
okay.
why I think it's like when we go in and we teach these movements, it's again, the research here is internal versus external feedback. When you try and tell an athlete how to move their body, it's never good for learning, because you're fighting the system, basically. You're fighting
yeah.
the way the body moves is so different for every player. Take shooting as one example.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Every player in Rip City, every player shoots so differently.
Mm.
So we can't go in and like try and get every player shooting the same. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't be effective.
Mm. Yeah.
And you know, even at the highest levels of our sport, we, you know, that this kind of isn't known. So that's what excites me about just how much potential there is. And I think over the next 10 years, the NBA is going to change enormously. And I believe that this skill acquisition will be the biggest part of that. And I think it's got the power to be like the next Moneyball. What Moneyball was
yeah.
in analytics, I think this could be the next wave.
Great comparison. Really good comparison. And so I guess as we kind of wrap up here, if over the next, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, we see kind of these things implemented more and more, how do you think that could change the game?
Absolutely. Great question. So I think the rules of the game are basically the task constraints, right? So
mm-hmm.
I think we would see new skills emerge, which would be fascinating. I think we'd have an even better product on display.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just think even from the perspective of fans watching, mm-hmm. how enjoyable that would be. Like, imagine if we could have, instead of one Steph Curry, like 10 players like Steph.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't want to kind of undersell just how incredible he is and how unique he is. But all I'm saying is I do think there's such undiscovered territory
mm-hmm.
in this space. So I think it could just be amazing to see. And I think that could even lead to different ways of playing basketball, different
yeah.
principles of play might emerge as coaches, you know, figure out how to use these players in different ways. And I think It's funny, Eric, because that's really how I started the book. And I was basically saying that the game is actually, it's continuously, basketball as a game is continuously evolving. It's every, the NBA changes the rules slightly every year. And obviously some years of rule change might be more drastic than others. But despite all of this, the coaching approaches we've used are basically the same as the 1950s. So my whole premise here is if we know the game is changing, the players are constantly changing, let's think about as coaches and all my stuff, it doesn't just apply to coaches, but athletic strength coaches, physiotherapists, like everyone in an organization, what does this mean for our role as a practitioner when we have this evidence and new information?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it could be quite different in, you know, a decade. It's really interesting. 100%. I saw that clip a couple days ago. You may have seen it where Jokic, I think he gets a steal like behind the other team's 3-point line and he goes to shoot a three, you know, and he gets fouled. And I since kind of coming in contact with some of your work, it made me think, oh, this is one of those things that is clearly showing within the rules there's something that should probably change, or at least there's something that one player has realized. If you're thinking about the game differently, this is something that maybe doesn't make sense given what we can do now versus when the rules were implemented or whatever.
That's exactly it. And I can tell you this, I actually, when I worked for the NBA league office, I had the pleasure, I spent time with Nicola in Sumbawa, where I helped run his youth camp, and the nicest guy ever. That was, you know, when he was really starting to get really big and just so welcoming and like no ego at all. But I can guarantee you, he would not have had, you know, been working with a skills trainer in his younger days. There's a famous photo of him as a youth player. And I think it's, you know, I think is the biggest thing which stands out to me is Jokic is a great example of a CLA player. And even if he didn't train in an environment where, you know, in the CLA, just in terms of his playfulness, his how he explores the whole time, how he's there's how he does some things, like even his shot, it may seem unorthodox, but it's highly effective how he gets it done. And imagine if one coach came in and tried to say to him, all right, this is the one thing you must do every time, you can't do your passes, you got to do a chest pass. I don't need to pass from one hand. But and it sounds funny, but the sad thing is here, Eric, that hundreds of thousands of coaches are saying this to their players every day, all over the world. And that's kind of what I'm trying to change or transforming. And it's maybe I'm being very ambitious, but I do feel like we are already just, we only started back in August, because before that, I was just sharing all my ideas kind of individually.
Yeah.
But I know we're having a big impact. And I think that's really what it comes down to. Can we make players have a far better experience of basketball, regardless of the level they're at, and actually have the coaches enjoy the process more as they go about it? And I really think that's what the CLA does.
Really amazing stuff. I think we will wrap up there, I guess, for today. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. This has been a really interesting conversation. And I just want to point anyone that is listening to check out your book and your podcast and learn more in depth about all the things we've been talking about today. So thank you so much for joining, Alex. I really appreciate it.
Eric, my pleasure. I loved it and your questions were excellent. So I really enjoyed the discussion. Thanks for all your support.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That'll do it for this episode of Kenny's G League. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've listened to either just this episode or every episode that we've done this season, I want to give a very sincere thank you to you. I really appreciate any and everyone that spent any amount of time following this podcast along during the season. Make sure you keep following. I should have one or maybe two more episodes before we call it a day and head to the G League off season. And then we'll come back perhaps around Summer League. We'll see what happens. And then into the next G League season. So again, thank you for listening. Whether you gave this only this episode a listen or every episode we've done, I really appreciate it. So keep following along and we'll see you on the next episode.